Welcome to Friday. Welcome to KOW's Week in Review. I'm Bill Radke, and get this. We're going to spend this hour discussing the news of the week with Crosscut's Knute Berger and Civic Cocktail's Joni Balter and The Stranger's Eli Sanders. Welcome, everybody.
Hey there.
Hey, Bill.
Nice to be here.
Nice to have you here. It is hard to believe. A year and a half ago, we were introduced to this.
When Mexico sends its people, they're not sending their best. They're not sending you. They're not sending you. They're sending people that have lots of problems, and they're bringing those problems with us. They're bringing drugs. They're bringing crime. They're rapists. And some, I assume, are good people.
Donald Trump announcing his run for president June of 2015, and now we near the finish line.
Let's get out and vote, and let's vote for the kind of future that we want, the kind of country that we want. Find your early voting location for the next 3 days. Please go take people there. We will show once and for all love trumps hate. Thank you all.
Hillary Clinton speaking yesterday in North Carolina, which is considered a must-win state for Trump. Today's Washington Post reads, from her high in the polls a week or two ago, Clinton's leads in a number of critical battleground states have collapsed or evaporated entirely. The election could come down to one state with four Electoral College votes that flips from Clinton to Donald Trump, and boom, a 269-269 Electoral College tie and a vote by the House of Representatives to decide on the next president, who, given the composition of the House, would almost certainly be Donald Trump. End of quote. And I chose to begin with this topic because I was going to say it was top of mind, and Knute said it's top of gut. It doesn't quite get up to mind.
Right. You barf before it gets there.
How you doing, everybody?
A little anxious. Yeah. You just made it more so with that paragraph. But I am crossing my fingers and toes for the early voters, the millions and millions of people who voted maybe before this week's news or even before that, and hopefully are going to help Hillary Clinton.
I'm thinking about those women voters who are going to save this country from Donald Trump. And it's not, in my, you know, my thinking is it's not so much about the idea that this guy's a Republican. That's not it. It's that he's so uncouth and so temperamentally unfit that it is actually a little unnerving to think about the paragraph you just read to us.
Are you addicted to coverage at this point? Have you blocked it out? What's happening?
I'm addicted. I mean, I'm checking Twitter and, you know, the news sites all the time, looking at the polls.
What do you get out of that? What is that doing for you?
It's nervous energy. It's just, you know, you can't be all buoyed by the polls, and then when the polls change, go all Donald Trump and say the polls don't matter, you know.
No, they're rigged.
Obviously, yeah, exactly. you know, obviously there is a trend going on. You know, he is doing better in the polls. It's a real horse race. We're literally not going to find out what happens. There's just kind of no real, it's a real nail biter, and the stakes are so high. In some ways, it's like a car accident. You can't help but look.
You've already voted.
Yes.
I haven't.
You haven't voted yet. Undecided voter Eli Sanders.
No. Late
we
voter.
We call those low information voters sometimes, don't we?
Procrastinating voter Eli Sanders. I was obsessed like Knute, and I hit some sort of overload. And I have actually pulled back from following the polls, following the coverage. I can't really take it. And I'm kind of saving my ballot for that last little bit of, okay, here's what I can do. Like, not everything I can do, but something. Put a stamp on it, mail it, and the rest is in other people's hands.
I asked Knute what his addiction, what his following the news does for him. What does your blocking it out do for you?
It gives me a little more equilibrium, I think, from as opposed to following the polls, which gyrate and affect my mood and my perception of which way the country's going. And since they change, I'm telling myself, well, just if you don't pay attention, they'll change back another way, you know, and if you don't pay attention long enough, as long as you vote, then you'll tune back in for the results.
Joni, what's the better approach? those two?
Well, I don't know. I think journalists by nature are adrenaline junkies. Let's all admit that. And then, you know, Eli's doing better. That's so good to hear. Do want to know how many times a day everyone around here checks the sort of Nate Silver versus New York Times numbers, because they actually change. They change often. I mean, some of us who are watching this are just zooming in on certain states. So, for example, Florida. And Florida's moving around, too. But there was a lot of early voting in Florida. There was a lot of early voting, period. 30 million people have voted already. And a lot of that voting took place when Trump wasn't as close as what the Washington Post is pointing out, and everyone else as well. So that's one thing for sure. But Florida is very, very important. And I do think, you know, if you put the rolling average, you're not supposed to respond to a single poll. That's not a good way to do it. Hillary Clinton's up by, you know, something that doesn't make people feel safe, calm, or cool.
The New York Times says Trump has the same chance as a kicker missing a short field goal. I don't know if you saw the Seahawks game.
That's
not a laughing matter to us.
You know, I'm barely articulate today because I was up all night with my 6-week-old twin grandkids.
Congratulations.
And this, yeah,
cool.
Thanks. But this creates a weekly bubble for me where you enter this sort of childcare bubble. It's a tweet-free zone. It's a poll-free zone. And, you know, I look at these
kids. How many times a day, Skip?
Are you reading
their poops? Not when I'm with the grandkids. What I'm saying is that there's a way it's kind of grounding when I focus on the madness of the polls and everything. But it's grounding to just actually have this basic human thing, which is feeding and diaper changing.
Then there's the weirdness of it seeming to matter so much how you feel, even though how you feel is completely irrelevant.
Yeah.
Right?
My father-in-law actually helped me disentangle from that. He was mocking me like, oh, you have to really pay close attention or else it won't go, you know, the way you want it.
Yeah.
Like you're carrying it, right?
Yeah, like my anxiety is going to affect anything outside of my own anxiety.
I told a friend, I said, I'm curious what a Trump presidency would be like. And he said, curious? My in-laws could be deported. I'm not curious. It was almost like a fight over how panicked you are over something that you... I was just saying, you know, it's like an earthquake that panicking isn't going to... about the possibility isn't going to do anything. But still, it was real, this contrast about... or how you feel seemed to matter.
I've seen that fight play out on Facebook, actually, recently, with people of color saying, you know, to white people who are expressing some anxiety, but also just kind of letting go, saying, you know, we don't have the luxury of completely letting go of fear in that way, that this is scarier to us than it could possibly be to you.
Yeah. Does that make it wrong to be the personality type who says, I hope an earthquake doesn't happen, but... I'm not telling somebody else how to feel. It's just my biorhythm.
Well, in fairness, the visits to psychologists and psychiatrists are up over this. Some people who have legitimate reasons are actually worried to the point that they're making appointments like this. This is not a fake thing. It's real.
If Trump wins, should Clinton accept the results?
Absolutely.
Or sue James Comey?
No. No sue, okay. Except. No sue, except. You have to let the democracy proceed.
Do you
but
expect-
if she wins, she should fire him. I mean, the FBI director does not seem to be doing his job.
Political firing. Fire your political enemy as soon as you get him.
The strongest thing would be to not fire him.
It's better than jailing them, which is what Donald Trump promised. Maybe Obama could fire him in his lame duck period. But
do you expect Trump to pull a stunt by Tuesday?
I think they sort of already have, in a way, pulled a stunt. Remember Rudy Giuliani saying that, you know, we have a few tricks up our sleeve, and now we're finding out that he knew in advance, seemed to know in advance, that the FBI was, I don't know if the right word's, reopening, relooking.
But that's not a Trump stunt.
Well,
it's not. They're tied at the hip.
He implied that they have some more tricks up their sleeve that, right, you know, between now and Election Day. But if it goes to the House of Representatives, the House doesn't have to pick anybody who is on the ticket. In other words, they can pick anybody. They could pick you, Bill. Mm. Get ready for the call.
The Electoral College.
Yes.
Yes, could pick.
No. The House of Representatives.
Oh, I
see. In other words,
yes.
If it's an electoral tie, it goes to the House of Representatives. Maybe they could pick James Comey.
But the Electoral College is set up that way, so they could pick somebody they wanted to. That's why the founders didn't want it to be direct democracy.
Well, they sign an agreement to follow the will of the voters.
Yeah.
But they don't have to.
Let's talk local election. What local races are you most watching?
I'm most watching Sound Transit 3 in the 7th Congressional District because I think Sound Transit 3 was pretty much a safe lock a couple of weeks ago. Pretty much every Seattle person was going to vote yes, suburbs less so. But I'm hearing that's tightening because it's becoming clear to people that it's extremely expensive. The idea that, they might not be able to afford a house in the future, but if this passes, they'll have a cute little train to ride around in. Hopefully there will be beds on there or something like that for those who couldn't afford the house to go with it. The other is the 7th Congressional District race. This was probably going to be Pramila Jayapal beating equally liberal, socially progressive Brady Walkinshaw. But I think that race must be tightening because of some of the sludge that has been going down, including Pramila Jayapal comparing Brady Walkinshaw to Donald Trump, which was just silly.
You think the race must be tightening? Is there any evidence to that? Or is it just feeling?
Just feeling. Okay. Just feeling. Anybody agree with me?
I've heard whispers of actual polling that has not been, introduced into public evidence that suggests that it might be tightening, but I haven't seen anything that I would.
James Comey says there may be polling that might mean something.
And Rudy Giuliani agreed with them because they say the same things when they're together.
How about you, Eli?
Well, I agree with Joni. I'm watching Sound Transit. The Stranger endorsed an approved vote on Sound Transit. We think it's important for the future of this region, for affordability, for social justice, for so many reasons. And I'm watching the 7th District race, which was a hard one for us to wrangle over and a really important one. Whoever wins, Brady Walkinshaw or Pramila Jayapal, is likely to be our representative for a very long time. Look at the example.
For 60 years.
Right. Look at the example of Jim McDermott, who, interestingly, has not endorsed in this race. He's been very quiet.
I hadn't noticed that.
Yeah, no endorsement from Jim. But I am watching some other down-ballot races also. First of all, people really need to pay attention to the state Supreme Court races. We've deliberated very carefully at The Stranger and made our endorsements in those. You can find them on our cheat sheet and in our long endorsements. But just like the U.S. Supreme Court, the state Supreme Court matters. And there's actually a lot of money being dumped into one particular state Supreme Court race that involves Justice Charlie Wiggins, who we've endorsed, and people like Steve Ballmer and some other very wealthy tech industry people who support charter schools, trying to kick him out of office basically because they don't like the Supreme Court's decision recently on charter schools. So there's a money and politics play that I find very distasteful to remove a very good justice.
And then, so separate from your personal political leanings on that or The Stranger's, does it feel like we shouldn't elect our judges? Does it feel like an improper mix of politics and judiciary?
It's felt like that to me for a long time. We were electing Supreme Court judges for many a time just by the name. Like if your last name was Johnson, you were good. That was the way to go. It just doesn't seem like it's informed enough to be the right way to go. And now with this money coming in, some of those same people tried to beat out Supreme Court Justice Barbara Madsen in the primary. It didn't work. She got 63.9% in the primary. So now they're picking on Wiggins.
I'm also watching the Secretary of State's race.
Oh, that's
there was
a good race.
A really big story in the New York Times today about the Koch brothers and other big conservative groups buying influence in Secretary of State races and offices because they see that secretaries of state control, for example, ballot language about initiatives, which are a way for the public to circumvent our gridlocked legislatures. And if you want to circumvent the public trying to circumvent the gridlocked legislatures, you invest a lot of money in secretaries of state who can put ballot language on that's more favorable to, say, tobacco companies, which one of the tobacco companies was big in this effort. So if you read the New York Times story, you see Kim Wyman, our current Republican Secretary of State, her influence being bought or attempted to be bought by these conservative groups. And this is a story that just came out today. And her challenger, Democrat Tina Podlodowski, is making a lot of noise about it, and rightly so.
Only conservative groups or liberal groups doing the same?
This story was about conservative groups doing this. The National Rifle Association, the National Restaurant Association, and a large tobacco company, and the Koch brothers. And then I also, in terms of down ballot races, I'm watching the carbon tax vote very closely. There's an opportunity for this state to make history in terms of a popular vote to institute a carbon tax and do something about global warming. I'm very aware of the kind of internecine fight on the left over this tax, but personally, I think it's important to vote yes and take a step forward. It's not the only step, and it's not a complete list of things that we should be doing for climate justice, but it's an important step forward.
I actually didn't plan to be telling people how to vote, but I'm any other things that you're following?
The only asterisk I would like to put on the Secretary of State's race is that, you know, Kim Wyman, the Republican, does have auditor's background, you know, election background, but Tina Podlodowski has tech background, and so I do think the cyber worries is the way to put it, make that sort of a closer call, and the polls show this to be a close race.
I'm watching some of the same races. Obviously, Sound Transit 3, I think, is fascinating. It's hugely consequential to the region, both if it passes or if it fails.
What's the biggest? If it fails, then they reintroduce a modified package.
But it would be much delayed. I mean, one of the criticisms of Sound Transit 3 is that it takes too long to roll out. Well, if you vote it down, it's going to take even longer. Guess what? And probably would be scaled back. Which
some people might like.
Some people negotiate with voters that way, or with
public agencies.
Sound Transit negotiates with voters that way over time.
Anyway, so I think that's a hugely consequential thing. I agree with Eli on the carbon tax. I think that's something that'll be kind of looked at nationally. It's not only an opportunity to see if the public will approve a carbon tax of this kind, but it also corrects some other deficiencies in our tax system, which I think is really interesting in terms of rolling back the sales tax, adjusting the B&O tax, which is hugely unpopular with a lot of small businesses. So it's a really intriguing piece of legislation. And then I agree with the Tina Podlodowski, Kim Wyman race for Secretary of State. The Republicans have held that office for a long time. They have run it in a fairly nonpartisan way all these years. Remember, it was Secretary of State Sam Reed who certified Chris Gregoire's election in a disputed election, and he took a lot of grief from Republicans for that. So I think Podlodowski's brought something very interesting to the race, which is a much more activist role in terms of making voting easier and pushing on the technology side. So that's a really interesting race to me.
Eli, you haven't filled out your ballot yet, but good luck figuring out whether to affirm the legislature's dental insurance extension by advisory vote. I mean, I thought long and hard about that. Argue with my wife, obviously.
Mm-hmm.
We're healing.
Yeah, you know? Really?
Yeah.
Over it now, fine.
Yeah.
The stranger has some very choice language about those.
They always have choice language.
Advisory votes.
Oh, yeah?
You know their origin is with Tim Iman. So we generally have some choice language about it. Mm-hmm. These are non-binding advisory votes, and every time the legislature does something related to taxes, basically, we spend the money to add volume to our ballots to have people make a mark about the tax, which has no actual effect. It's just an advisory vote.
But it does make your ballot require two stamps in some cases.
Some counties.
Yeah. Thanks, Tim Iman.
And which of the candidates for lands commissioner would set fire to our state parks? You know, that's what I want to know. I don't want to choose that person.
But why?
Well, because it just seems like an extreme thing to do. Just tell me which lands commissioner candidate. And then finally, did you read about the group that's mailing out lists of who has voted and who hasn't?
That's right.
In this case, it's a conservative group mailing to conservative zip codes, but liberal groups could do the same, and maybe they are. How do you feel about that? A group kind of saying, we're going to let everybody know whether you voted or you haven't as a push to get
the vote. Well, since it's coming from a group that's targeting its own voters, a GOP-based group.
In this case,
I mean, they're clearly saying that if you don't vote, because a lot of people are unenthusiastic this year, you think, you know, and so they're saying, you know, we will find out about you and tell your neighbors that you are not behaving in a responsible civic way. But what's
well, they're just telling your voter, your neighbors that you didn't vote and
same,
how your neighbors
same diff,
decide.
Same
okay.
diff. But it is a way of sort of shaming people into thinking they better vote. But they're not talking to all the voters. They're only, in this case, they're only talking to a group that they think will vote for the GOP.
Right.
You know, conservatives used to be the party of privacy. You know, they were against ID chips. They were against government intrusion. It's flipped in such an amazing way.
Although I did see the liberal equivalent of this on Facebook this morning, actually, an Amy Schumer piece, a video where she says, I just want to remind you, you know, I'm not going to tell you that you have to vote, although I think you're a terrible person if you don't vote. But I also want to remind you that your vote is a public record. And if you don't vote, everyone will know. So same thing, that attempt to use the shaming function of social media, which can be very negative in a lot of moments, but I guess to try to harness it in a positive direction to get people to turn out to vote.
At the Seattle Times, a perennial story that we would run would be to go look and see which politicians hadn't voted and print that one.
Speaking of social media, thanks to social media, nothing is unobjectionable. And so I wonder if anyone has a problem with the cup that I'm holding. Have you seen the Starbucks cup that rolled out this week? Apparently, some people are mad because either because it's political or it's not red. I've never met these people, I should stipulate. But the cup has about 150, I've heard, it looks like more, people drawn in one continuous line by a Seattle artist named Shogo Ota, who says he wanted to connect people.
I wanted to draw everybody in one line. My dad, my son is here. In that way, it's personal. Everybody, like from babies to grandma, grandpa, people should feel everybody's equal and happy together. That sounds pretty peaceful to me. I feel like I'm doing something good. Yeah.
Everybody equal and happy together? That's too political for me on social media. Is it political?
No, but I will say I think Howard Schultz is the most frustrated non-politician that we know. He likes to get involved in civic issues. He's also not too bad at marketing. Here we are once again as this pre-holiday, can I say pre-holiday? Every pre-holiday, we're talking about what the cup has on it or doesn't have on it. Mm. So that's not bad either. And I will say, in Mr. Schultz's defense, that he did end up on a sort of a medium-long list of Hillary Clinton's possible vice presidents. Didn't make it in the end, but, you know.
So we know he's a Democrat. Is he being bold and to hell with the investors with the Race Together and Unity Cups, or does he think his public face is a moneymaker?
I think he's being a little cheesy, honestly, but, you know, probably with good intentions. And the headline of the story that you sent about this really says it all about how this is received and about this country right now. Starbucks new Unity Cups have Americans divided.
That is a fabulous headline.
It's a really great headline.
Again, I need to stress that this involves six tweets. So I'm estimating.
How many people really hate this?
Truly, yeah.
Yeah, well, maybe Starbucks is putting those tweets out themselves.
Right.
But the sad thing about it is when you walk up to the Starbucks, they have the design in the window. And the slogan for the campaign is, be good to each other. I mean, what does it say? You know, that is politically divisive.
Yeah. Right.
Be good to Starbucks and buy a bunch of stuff inside.
Would you thought it was political if Clint Eastwood drew it? If it was a Chick-fil-A cup, would you say, keep your politics out of my chicken latte? Delicious.
I think I'd have more to say about the chicken latte.
Don't worry, folks. Your red cup will come. I know it will. I just know. Just hang in there. And hang in there for a week in review. We're going to talk about a tax on foreign buyers. We're going to talk about turning yourself into a rose bush or what have you. Your mortality and recomposition and more coming up. This is KUOW's Week in Review. I'm Bill Radke, figuring out what happened this week and why it matters with Joni Balter and Eli Sanders and Knute Berger. Most expensive place in North America to buy a house, Knute? Any idea?
Oh, I have the feeling it's a place close by.
It's not far. Yeah, just over the past the arch. One reason that Vancouver, BC is so expensive, just one reason, is that Chinese investors are buying up property there. So Vancouver put a 15% tax on any foreign buyer. And so far, prices actually haven't fallen. Home sales have plunged. Now, Seattle cannot legally impose a foreign buyer tax, but could you see the city ever asking for permission to do that?
I've been waiting to hear Shama Sawant raise this because it sounds like her kind of thing. She wants Seattle to raise an income tax, even though there's debate over whether Seattle has legal authority to do that. Her issue is affordable housing, or one of her major issues, and I have not heard her yet say this, which has shocked me. But I think that Seattle could rattle the cage about it and try to get Olympia to do something.
The it's really interesting because the tax came about as a result of the real estate prices in Vancouver and the fact that they call it hedge city up there because so much money is coming in as people hedge their bets in China and whatnot. It's a wash in cash. A lot of people who are buying these properties don't live in them. They buy them for a single family.
They keep them empty.
That's right. And a single family detached home average price, $1.9 million. Before the tax, those have actually gone down by about $400,000 Canadian. So there has been an effect. Mm. Polling in Vancouver says 9 out of 10 Vancouverites approve of the tax.
So Vancouver is a heavily Asian city.
It is. And in fact, the Asian population there is very much in favor. Everybody's affected by these prices. Toronto is now looking at putting in the tax. There's a question as to whether it's legal. Whether it violates the North American Free Trade Agreement, for example. I think it would be very difficult in the United States to do this. But in the provincial government in BC signed off on it. And they've also said that other Pacific Rim hotspots like Hong Kong and Singapore have done something similar. So it's not like they just made it up out of whole cloth. This is a way of stemming foreign investment from taking over the entire arc of development in a city.
Well, also it's about affordable housing, if you think about it. So Vancouver is the San Francisco, is what I'm trying to say here, of Canada. You know, it's a beautiful place, not a big landmass. They're trying to get their arms around this rapidly escalating housing prices. And, you know, folks here in Seattle have talked about what to do about Airbnb. And not the Airbnb where you live in the house, but the Airbnb where a piece of property, a bit of housing, is used exclusively for Airbnb. And the city council is trying to get their arms around that.
So that's one less house somebody could rent.
Right, and that's the thinking.
And it ticks prices up.
You can sort of understand why government would want to do, and why you'd see polling like that. You can sort of understand why government wants to do something for the folks who are really about living in that city and who already live there and not wanting to chase out everybody who can't afford the rapidly rising prices.
And when I say, by the way, Vancouver is a heavily Asian city, I just mean significantly. You know, it's not majority Asian, but there's not a backlash in Vancouver of that this is xenophobic.
I don't think it's about anything like that, about disliking foreigners. I think it's about disliking rising housing prices and saying, you know, we got to do something about that. And you know, that knowing, so the foreigner part comes in because they're not actually living there, you know, full time in any way. They're buying the property as an investment.
Well, it's scary when you look at Vancouver, which is supposed to be the model for Seattle, which is increased, you know, lots of density, lots of rail, go build high, build skinny towers and that kind of thing. And so if you do all that and you still face this problem, you know, there's another sort of systemic force that's, causing the calculation to go off. And one of the problems Vancouver has is there's a mass exodus of young people in Vancouver. They're going to other cities, or they're going out into the region. They're going to Vancouver Island and commuting. That's sort of the the new big thing there. They can't afford to live in the city anymore, and I think people in the city recognize that's a problem.
And that gets to kind of the basic fairness argument that was made very successfully for the $15 minimum wage here. If you work in the city, you should be able to earn a wage that allows you to afford to live in this city. We heard that with 15, right? And so if the average home price, or if a lot of the home prices, are just way beyond what anyone who's even well compensated, middle class or upper middle class in a city, can afford, it becomes just absurdly unfair to the average person. And the fear in Seattle, just to put a fine point on it, is that when the money is stopped from flowing into Vancouver by that tax, it will come down here. And in fact, the fear is that it already has. There's a story in the Seattle Times this morning about a record number of Seattle homes now fetching more than $1 million in prices.
And this may be happening in Bellevue even more. Folks have noticed that.
Yeah, the Seattle Times quoted China's biggest website, real estate website devoted to people buying, foreigners buying, investing, and that Seattle, the Seattle area, particularly Medina, Mercer Island, maybe parts of Bellevue, Lake Washington area, are that this is the number one destination
because
now for
it's
Chinese
a steal
investors.
To them, because it's at the moment it's less than San Francisco and less expensive as well than Vancouver.
Why is Vancouver that much more expensive than here or even San Francisco?
I'm not sure, but I was just thinking.
Just a little historical perspective was British Columbia and Vancouver specifically in 1986 when they hosted Expo, purposely did that to encourage Chinese investment in Vancouver. This is a product of Vancouver seeking that money over the last 30, 40 years.
So that's
years.
Reason number one for
that's
the difference
number
is Chinese.
One is yes. And then the Hong Kong spurred it when Hong Kong went back to being part of mainland China. Mm-hmm. A lot of money fled Hong Kong and went to Vancouver. So there have been a number of issues like that that have spurred that.
On the PR front of this, the public relations debacle of buying an expensive house as someone who doesn't live in a city and then having no one live in it, right? Mm-hmm. Just parking your money in the house. I've wondered why there hasn't been an effort to just let someone live in that house. You know, if people want to come to Seattle, for example, and buy expensive homes just as a way of parking money, run up real estate prices and leave this vacant housing, why not actually put some people in that housing?
Yeah. Doesn't tech give us the chance to hook those parties up? Look, you're investing it.
Yeah. Just Airbnb.
Yeah.
It's kind of the Airbnb is what I'm thinking of.
The Airbnb of foreign investing.
Right. So we'll see whether Seattle, by the way, to be clear, doesn't have the legal authority now.
It's not clear if Vancouver does either. It's not clear.
Yeah, that's right. They may be fighting about it in Vancouver as well. But Shama Sawant or whoever could start to rattle that cage.
It seems like a Sawant issue. Even if Seattle doesn't have an authority to do it, that hasn't stopped her before.
KUOW's Week in Review marches to its demise in a moment, and we'll talk about Sports Stadium 2, Life After Death. The stadiums will always, professional sports will outlast us all. Stay tuned. KUOW's Week in Review. I'm Bill Radke with Eli Sanders, Joni Balter, and Knute Berger. This week, KUOW reminded you that you will die someday. You're welcome.
Thank you.
Thanks, Bill.
I interviewed a Seattle woman named Katrina Spade, who's working on a combination funeral home compost bin where you would carry your loved one in a shroud up a circular ramp, up, and ceremonially lay the body in wood chips where it would decompose and gradually filter downward with other bodies and eventually become soil that you could plant with.
For me, it's very comforting to imagine that after I die, I can rejoin the ecosystem in a sort of pure way, stop being human. So for me, there's just more meaning in decomposing naturally and being used again to grow life.
She's testing this at a North Carolina college now. She's going to test it at Washington State University, where they already compost livestock, and she hopes to build the first facility in Seattle. Knute, are you in? Are you soil?
We mean in.
No. I mean, I'm fine if people want to do that way. There are several things that bother me about it. One is it feels like kind of a mass grave. I don't like that idea.
What's wrong with that? The earth is a mass grave.
I like the idea of having dark, one's though. Own plot, having one's own headstone or plaque or, you know, something like that.
Uh-huh.
I love the idea. I love history. I love archaeology. I want somebody to dig me up in 500 years.
That's true. They found Richard III's bones under a parking lot. That was cool.
I'm not saying I'm any Richard III, but, you know.
Well, listen, Richard, do you want family members to come and stand over where you last were?
I don't want to be sprinkled on the garden.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I understand. I mean, eventually we're all going to end up there anyway and dust to dust, right? But
yeah, a listener named Lee agrees with you, wrote to us, it feels like it crosses a line of respect for human life, which should be different from cabbages, spoiled tomatoes, etc.
Well, no one is going to force you to choose decomposition over burial as we know it right now. But I actually think there's something quite nice about the idea. I don't see it as that different from cremation and sprinkling ashes, except that it allows you to give more nutrients back to the soil and sustaining future life. And there is something unsustainable about the idea that every human who has ever lived can and should be given a piece of space of their own on the surface of the earth.
Yeah, Canute, why you got to take up space?
He's already taking
up
space. Okay,
I want to be like a treasure chest. I want somebody in 400 years to dig me up and go, wow, look at that ring he's wearing.
I thought you were going to say time capsule.
Oh, well, exactly. It's all the same thing. It's like time capsule. It's like you're a little time capsule there in the cemetery. And people, they'll analyze your DNA and they'll figure out who you really were related to and all kinds of stuff.
He's a historian.
I love forensics.
That's a historian's point of view.
Forensics.
Yeah. I have to approach this with a short story about my great aunt who lived to 107. And in her will, she said she lived in like the worst house you could live in Beverly Hills. And she said she wanted to be buried in the backyard under the fig tree. This was in her will. And so she asked my uncle, who happened to be involved with Beverly Hills city government, to bury her under this fig tree. In the middle of the night, he granted her wishes. About a year later, the house was sold. Somebody came in, dug everything up. New house, lot line to lot line. We don't know what happened because it was out of our control. But the asterisk to this is that my husband went out and planted a fig tree recently. So I think he has. I think he has big plans for me, is what I'm saying.
We need to start Joni watch.
Yeah. If Joni goes missing, you know where to look.
I did that to protect myself.
So do you tell your family? Like, I tell my wife, just say you're going to compost me, even if you won't. Because if it actually does gross her out, why would I do that to her? But I want to spend my remaining time thinking I am the lemon tree.
So you're in.
I'm totally in. I think it's great.
Yeah, I'm with you.
I'm comforted by it. I'm not weirded out. Yeah.
The only thing that I could see, I don't know if this would sway me, but there are a lot of like techno futurists, right, who have started believing that we can bring people's brains or bodies back to life at a future point, and they want to like freeze them for that. I don't think you can do that.
That is going to be a tough call. How do you go in there and kind of retrieve?
I don't think the track record on frozen human heads is very good.
I'm not going to be.
Places always go bankrupt or something.
Let's be honest.
Already composted human heads, like the track
record. Zero chance.
Yeah.
But let's be honest. I'm not on anybody's list, reviving list. So Sam writes to us, stick me under your raised bed garden. Who needs manure and fertilizer? Just rototill in a human. Ellen says, I want to help grow blueberries. Do you know what you want to be? I was thinking a corpse flower.
Well, a fig,
you know,
Joni has said, is actually quite
really
beautiful.
Fig is nice.
They stink.
They stink, but I spent my lifetime on Earth putting on deodorant, trying to change my stuff.
This is the unread.
It's time to relax. a corpse flower blooms like once a decade, and everybody just seems to love it. They smell like they smell, and people line up to be near it. Corpse flower doesn't care.
That's a good one. We'll bury you under the corpse flower, Bill.
He already said he wanted to be a lemon tree.
Yeah. It's up to you.
I don't know what I would want to be. I like the idea of becoming a part of a number of things underneath, you know, the person who said, bury me under the vegetable garden or whatever.
Sebastian says, compost me. If anyone dares to embalm me and seal me in a casket, I will haunt you forever. So that's just a note to Sebastian's loved ones. You don't want to make that decision very, very carefully. All right, this is KOW's Week in Review. Let's come to the mortal end of that particular discussion and then kick it back up again with basketball and hockey players and a few other things before the Week in Review concludes. Knut Berger is the Mossback at Crosscut.com. Joni Balter hosts Civic Cocktail on the Seattle Channel. Associate editor at The Stranger, Eli Sanders, is author of While the City Slept, and we're bringing you the Week in Review. And this week, Seattle political and financial players have been thinking about basketball and hockey players. A rich investor changed the stadium equation when he offered the city a new deal. He'll pay for a new Soto Stadium if the city will reduce some taxes, to which the mayor said maybe, but as he told 710 ESPN, he might renovate Key Arena.
Sports politics is new to me. And navigating sports politics has been one of the stranger experiences of my many years in politics. So, you know, having said that, I come at this a little, as I said, with less invested interest in one version or another. I mean, I am committed, and I launched an effort just a few weeks ago for the revitalization of the Seattle Center, engaging with the school district about what we do with Memorial Stadium. If Sound Transit 3 passes a station actually at the Seattle Center, how do we create more open space? What are we going to do with those parking lots that city owns? There's a whole bunch of questions, including the dark west side where Key Arena is. So I have to ask, since that's a city asset, if not this, then what?
The dark west side of Seattle Center.
Yeah, there you
What's going to happen?
Well, you know, I had that very same mayor on Civic Cocktail this week, and he said pretty much the exact same thing. But what was interesting is I could tell he loved the idea of being in the middle of a couple of suitors here that might bring basketball back. Who wouldn't? It's competition.
Playing one off another to get the best
indeed.
Deal.
He had this smile on his face. He's digging this because he really likes the idea of getting the best deal out of it. Chris Hansen has come up with a better deal, which is now he's not going to have direct public money, although I think he's asking for some taxes to be waived, which
yes.
is also public money. But, you know, the city has had a problem on that dark west side, and it's called Key Arena. What to do with it? And so I don't blame him for wanting to listen to that idea, whatever it is. There's nothing specific down on the table. I will say if the mayor wants to drive to Queen Anne around 4 o'clock some afternoon, he might discover not that easy to access, a lot of traffic. I don't know if he's heard.
The dark west side of Key Arena, I felt like that's where Springsteen started to change. I started losing him after that album. What's going to happen? I mean, if the NBA seems to love new arenas, so is Mayor Murray really keeping alive an NBA option if what he wants to do is renovate Key Arena?
Well, I think he is. There are a couple things on that front, which is that, I mean, one of the reasons the Sonics left was because the city wouldn't pony up, or this is the ownership, you know, the city wouldn't pony up to refurbish Key Arena, which it had very recently refurbished to make compatible for the Sonics. There's been a belief that the NBA would not consider Key Arena, that they have scratched that off their list. One, the new commissioner has said that isn't the case. Two, the city commissioned a report, and this was after the EIS for the Soto Arena, commissioned a report looking at what to do with Key Arena. They found a very viable way to adapt it for both the NBA and for hockey. And they also looked at other options, you know, using it as some other kind of convention center, tech center, various things. And I think what's driving the mayor's enthusiasm is the fact that there are several major arena developer companies that have come forward and said, we're interested in redeveloping it for NBA, for hockey, and for other purposes. And I think he's doing his due diligence to say, let's look at those proposals.
I think the good news for Seattle in that is that those new groups are tied. They have close ties to arena development and close ties to the NBA. And that means, to me, reading between the lines, that the NBA is kind of interested in coming back to Seattle for obvious reasons, a growing place, right? And so I think the winks and all of that are all about, yeah, it might happen. And so that's why you see people lining up to get in on the good fortune here.
And Joni alluded to this earlier, but it's also a much better position for Ed Murray and the council members to be in politically. Rather than looking like they're giving out kind of the Seattle equivalent of a no-bid contract to one really rich guy who has one particular vision, they've now got multiple offers or potentials on the table, and they can please sports fans because, hey, we've got a couple paths to this, and they can please the watchdog element of Seattle, which is very strong and very concerned about public money going to sports arenas, and say, hey, we are pitting these people against each other to get the best deal for taxpayers.
Right. Do you think the city, do you think Mayor Murray and the council have a preference over where this stadium would go if it's happening?
Well, the Dark West Side was a little bit of a clue.
Yeah.
No, but also, I mean,
he really wants to put that traffic in the middle of Seattle Center, South Lake Union, et cetera.
We're going to have to get there in jetpacks probably. But, you know, there is so much opposition to the Soto site that it is tough to navigate. You have the port. They're still not happy. The Mariners, they're still not happy. But wait till you say Key Arena and you'll find out who's not happy on that one, because it is so hard to navigate that corridor there through Mercer.
And, you know, be careful about a sports team. Did you see how miserable Chicago has been for 108 years? I keep seeing this week about Chicagoans crying because their grandparents never got to see the Cubs win and they died heartbroken. And it's awful to me. And just so when you think about the cost of a new team, are we considering the misery people feel every time they're not the champions, which is almost every year?
A little overstated, but here's the thought.
I'm not crying. You should see the people whose tears. I've seen people weep. Friends of mine.
Well, you know, that is a long stretch without a championship, and Chicagoans have rightly wept about that, I think. But, you know, having it.
You don't care about their pain.
I care this much, okay. a bit much. But, you know, look, we here have the Mariners whenever we feel we don't touch that enough, right?
I was just thinking about the 104-year-old who had been composted and therefore had no chance of any way coming back to hear about the Cubs.
They even haunt the Cubs.
Yeah, can't even haunt or be a zombie or anything.
Right, right.
They're a carrot that someone
it's just ate. A carrot. Joni doesn't care that you're a carrot. Tweet that, social media producer Ron Huberman. Let people figure it out. It's a distraction from the election.
He's going willingly to Carrothood. That's what he said.
I don't get the cult of the Cubs. I mean, I understand why people in Chicago care about it.
Yes.
Yeah. No, I get that. But it seemed like it took on this kind of national thing. Like, oh, Bill Murray. I mean, who gives it?
Who cares? Yeah.
You know, and so it just seems sort of bizarre to me. But I also have to confess that many of my in-laws are from Cleveland, Akron, whatnot. So there were a lot of Indian fans by extension. I didn't care particularly.
Are they ashamed of Chief Wahoo? Do they think they didn't deserve to win?
My wife calls the Indians the epithets.
The epithets.
The Cleveland epithets. She won't say, they're appalled.
Well, that's the thing.
They are very liberal Ohioans, and they're appalled by the mascot and the
Well, somebody has to be the lovable loser now, because the Boston Red Sox were that for a long time. They had the curse of the Bambino and all that, and they finally won a few years ago. The Chicago Cubs had the goat curse or whatever that thing was, and they never won. They finally did this week. So doesn't that make the Seattle Mariners America's new lovable losers?
Yeah. We're well on
our way. We're it. Because it should be the Cleveland Indians, who haven't won in 80 years themselves, but Chief Wahoo.
We've never been to a World Series, period.
Right, ever.
And
Chief Wahoo.
I don't expect anybody else in the country to give a rip.
Right.
Yeah, but I don't think anyone else in the country thinks that Seattle's suffering as a sports town. See the Huskies, the Seahawks.
That's Sounders. True.
I mean, we're doing
angry Sonics fans.
Except for the angry Sonics fans, and people are working on their problems as we speak.
Right. So we need to be a little more pathetic before we're America's lovable losers.
Yes. Words to live by.
Words to live by.
We want to be more pathetic. Yay.
Hey, Whitman College. By the way, I think we need a curse, though, because they had the real lovable losers have a curse, and we don't have a supernatural.
Maybe the ghost of Bill the Beer Man or something.
We're so solution-oriented on the arena, so techno-future, tech-money-oriented. We should just give up and say we're cursed.
The ghost of Jeff Smolian.
Need a little magic.
The ghost of Jeff Smolian, who tried to take our team to Tampa. There you go.
Whitman College just got rid of its non-inclusive imperialistic mascot. Did you hear about that?
Yeah.
Whitman was the missionaries forever, and that was good for naughty jokes, obviously, and they got a lot out of that, but it was time for that to end because the missionaries, the real missionaries, did actually...
They became compost.
They tried to...
They are in a mass grave.
Yes. Wow, that got dark.
Well,
I mean... The missionaries had an unsavory past, let's just say, with the converting and the wiping out. Okay, so Whitman said, look, we probably should drop the missionaries. So students and faculty and staff and alumni, what should we do? And they had four finalists. They had the Appaloosas, as in the horse. They had the Blue Ravens, revered bird. They had the Sockeyes. But the winner is the Whitman Blues.
What is a blue?
It's a mountain.
Yeah, the Blue Mountains.
It's a range.
Get out of Seattle every now and again.
They're beautiful. They're beautiful. Bigfoot lives there, too.
Is that right?
Sure.
I didn't know that's where Bigfoot is.
Yeah, that's where he is right now.
Oh, man.
Yeah.
One of them?
The students decided to change the name of the student paper also, by the way. And I don't know what the new name is, but the old name was the Pioneer.
So I know the new name.
What is it?
Yeah, well, so the Pioneer also... problematic that the newspaper is now called the Whitman Wire.
The Whitman Wire.
Named after something that
retro.
Yeah, just to be retro. So you have blues and you have the wire. Like we're back. It's throwback.
Sounds like Kansas City in the jazz era or something.
Yeah, we have the Utah Jazz. You got the Whitman, blues. Well known for its Delta blues. Its history of deep history of the.
I wonder what color their uniform will be.
That seems easy.
Easy. Gold like wheat. And by the way, John Moe, a former KOW and a Seattleite, he did his own poll, and it came out differently. It was 15% some horse. This is on Twitter. My college asked me to vote. He's a Whitman alum, so he was on the list. He got to vote. 15% some horse, 17% depressing music, so the blues didn't fare well. 25% some weird bird, he says. And then 43%, the winner, dumb resolute fish because of the sockeyes. And some people actually want dumb resolute fish to just be, there's your mascot.
That's just good luck beating. Rolls off the tongue perfectly.
Perfect. Yeah.
There's your
makes
new,
it hard on the cheer squad.
Your new loser cult team.
Knut Berger, Joni Balter, Eli Sanders. Wow, it'll be different when we talk next time. Thank you, everybody, for a week in reviewing with us.
Thank you, Bill.
Thank you.
Thanks for joining us on Twitter @KUOW.